Shall we start? It's a great pleasure to introduce Norbert Walter, who has been chief economist of the Deutsche Bank for 14 years. It's a particular pleasure for me to introduce him because for 5 years in the early 1990s, I was the Deutsche Bank Walter F. Hallstein Fellow at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and was thus funded by Deutsche Bank. And I remember a delicious dinner at which I met Deutsche Bank staff in London and asked them, tell me what is it you would like me to do for you in return, to which they answered, we thought that was an illegitimate question to ask. Deutsche Bank does support academic endeavors for the public good and not for its own interests. Norbert Walter has been a policy-oriented economist, a first-class economist, but someone who's been engaged in policy debates, certainly for as long as I've known him, within the European context, on a transatlantic and OECD basis, and very much concerned, therefore, with the whole argument over different models of capitalism, economic reform in Europe, what some of us like to call the Lisbon Agenda, and then have great difficulty explaining it to our students. And I have no doubt that he is going to talk on all of those issues this evening. Norbert.
William, thank you for the introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, you should have a warning or the answer to my question first. Europe certainly is not, and during my lifetime will not be, a pillar of the world economy, but will be the appendix. There is no need for Europe to remain the appendix, but we seem to be determined to not change it. Second, a remark. You should be warned. My remarks are quite emotional. And I've learned in my long life as a forecaster that there is such a thing like an optimal distance to an object. And if you are too close, you don't see. And if you are too far, you don't see either. I'm too close to Europe. I love Europe. I'm emotionally attached to Europe. And therefore, I'm not an objective observer. And please bear with me. That's the reality that has formed me. My formation is like that. In order to make this understood, I just have to tell you that my two grandfathers died at the age of 25 and 27 respectively in the battlefield of Verdun, and there they are buried. My father was fighting in the battlefield against Russians and French in the field and came back after years of imprisonment and disabled. I'm the first in the family who has lived for almost 60 years in peace and in developing prosperity as a consequence of Europe becoming a different place. And it was the great leadership of political figures who understood that we could not repeat the past. The de Gasperis, the Henri Sparks, the de Gaulles, the Adenauers are not studied, are not understood today. And they have no followers. They have no successors. And the people of Europe are not existent. And most people in European countries don't care, my own included. If we would have a poll, a referendum today on whether we could get rid of the euro, we would have clearly a majority of people who want to get rid of this damn thing. The Coal and Steel Union, the European Economic Union, the setup of the European Commission, and the emerging of an infant parliament of Europe, in my view, are very lucky events, are very important decisions that still give us some structure that helps us to not derail the process of European integration. Again, if you would ask the people today, we would not have any chance for a new mandate for European integration. After having stated that, you might ask, why are you doing that? Aren't you observing that there is an obvious demand of new countries to become members of the club? And it's true. In May of 2004, we will not add a small number, but 10 new countries. And we then will be a club of 25 European nations forming the European Union. And there were referenda in the member countries, in most of the member countries, and there was not too bad a turnout and a clear majority of joining. If you address the question why these countries, the Hungarians or the Poles, voted for the European Union, in Western Europe, it's very obvious what your citizens will tell you. They are just interested in our money. European citizens live in nation states with a government, with a share of government of close to 50%. The European budget effectively amounts to a good 1% of GDP. And the maximum for it is 1.27%. Still, the perception of the European citizen is Europe is the biggest monster ever, the biggest bureaucratic monster ever. It enforces upon us the strangest things. And they, of course, they believe that we are capable of doing great big transfers and subsidies for these new members. Rubbish. Just complete rubbish. Again, all of our countries have a government sector of about 50% of GDP, and the European budget is something like 1%. So much for the facts. And even worse, more than 50% of the European budget is for nothing else but for the common agricultural policy, which is not exactly to help the Baltic states, but which is obviously exactly for helping French and German farmers and some British. This morning, we have started the preparation for this year's, which is the 14th Frankfurt European Banking Congress. It's going to take place, as always, on the third Friday in November. And we have to be creative this morning in order to identify what the agenda for this meeting should be. And one of the headlines that I invented was Europe stuck. Europe, heavyweight without impulse. And then I was criticized for being too negative. And then I said, let's do it in a more charming way. And probably the title will be Lisbon Goodbye. And we will invite President Putin, because we know he will be reelected. It's almost as certain as George W. Bush being reelected. And he may greet the Congress with the headline, Goodbye Lisbon, by Hello, here is Moscow. Again, it's quite obvious. Looking at Europe from outside, it seems to be more attractive than if you are part of it, and if you look at it from the inside, and if you have prejudices, as the European citizens have. In the past decades, Europe was moved forward by forward-oriented and truly committed European politicians. And the last couple of politicians that were like that were Jacques Delors, Commission President and engine of the European single market and the European currency union. And of course, the two figures that put political weight behind these ideas, namely François Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl. Without those three people, Europe would not have developed the momentum in the latter part of the 80s, would not have digested the southern integration, the integration of the pigs, Portugal, Greece, Spain. What is I? Ireland. This has happened at a time when there were questions whether these countries, non-democratic, very far behind in economic terms, having shown no real convergence, they would be candidates that would dilute the European idea. And the fact was, the opposite was true. They helped Europe to gain momentum. I admire the new applicant countries, that their willingness to join Europe came so early, because these were countries that only regained national sovereignty at the end of the 80s. And to give up part of the national sovereignty as early as after 10 years is certainly something we, in older democracies, should understand as being something that is very bold, very difficult to convey to the citizens. But it still happened. And if you look into what has happened in those applicant countries in terms of democratic institutions, in terms of market orientation, in terms of international integration, it is truly something to worth write home about. Where do we go from here? We are obviously behind the Lisbon agenda, and not just behind, but a lot. In 2000, the heads of state declared that by 2010, Europe should be the number one knowledge-based society of the world. When I read the communique, I didn't believe that it was true. I believe it must be fool's day, because I never, never, ever would have expected the European heads of state to come up with such a statement. But I was very happy that they made the statement. I only would have expected such a statement from politicians coming from the country that is used to boasting, the United States. But I wouldn't have expected it from Europeans, culturally advanced Europeans. This was almost like the Avis slogan, "We try harder." But unfortunately, after this declaration of a target, little or nothing happened. And in 2004, when reviewing the process, we found out that we are a lot behind, and that the ambition to move things forward is again in a very difficult spot after the big effort of the Giscard group, the convention, ran into the stone wall of objections, and particularly the objections of two countries, Poland and Spain. And we now are without a draft for a constitution. We cannot start the process of ratification. It is quite obvious that the issue that is controversially debated, namely the voting rights, is something we Europeans, if we want to win over the people of Europe, have to be very serious. If we want to develop a democratic legitimation of this European entity, the European Parliament could not possibly deviate too much from the rule, from the democratic rule of one man, one vote. We could not possibly have a representation in the European Parliament that gives a person in Luxembourg 8 times the vote to a vote in Germany. That's not reasonable and should not be advocated. So the one man, one vote orientation for the weights in Parliament should be an obvious one. On the other hand, it is equally obvious if Europe tries to develop a consent, an acceptance, then minority rights have to be taken very seriously at the same time. And therefore, we badly need a very considerable representation of the interest of smaller countries in something like a second chamber where the states are represented. And it's very obvious that the old Europe, the Europe of the 9, the 6, the 9, the 15, benefited a lot from the small countries' contributions and influences. It was very, very important and reasonable for the big guys to respect the small guys and their contributions. Therefore, the double voting system suggested by the convention, in my view, is a very appropriate solution to this very problem. And we ought to insist that these principles have to be respected. The Nice Treaty, which is today the treaty that is relevant, has such complicated voting rights that to form coalitions to get something done in Europe is not realistic to be expected in many cases. So if we remain stuck with the voting system of the Nice Treaty, Europe will not move forward. It did not move forward when we were 15. It will not at all move forward after we are a Europe of 25. And before 2010, Europe will be a Europe of 30. I'm not particularly talking about Turkey. I'm particularly addressing the issue of former Yugoslavia and the application of some of their member states to the club. They will be, in my view, on board, of course, after Romania and Bulgaria. Will Europe develop in order to be capable to make decisions? Will the decisions that are intended by the draft for the Constitution be helpful? Will the very fact that we have not a rotating presidency, changing every 6 months, support the stature of Europe? Will a president of the Council for a period of 3 years imply that Europe can talk at eye level with the other important players around the globe? These are questions, and I have no ready answers. There are some optimists who believe that either the Irish presidency in the first half of 2004 or the Dutch presidency in the second half of this year will achieve a compromise and will make it possible to overcome the deadlock that we ran into with the Nice Treaty. Some others claim that the draft of the convention is anything but desirable, that it is not appropriate and has to be adjusted on many fronts, and we should use the extra time that now is given to us for a thorough debate, for a debate on many levels, and we then should come up with a more reasonable draft of the Constitution. I myself have a number of important criticisms of the draft treaty. And I would be quite happy if we could change that. But I'm not just only a theoretician. I'm a practical man, and I know If we open Pandora's box, it will be very difficult to get it closed again. And therefore, I would indeed accept the draft in almost all the elements that are there, rather than delaying the process and having to rely on the Nice Treaty for a number of years. There are quite a few guys who believe that it is to be even preferred that we don't move forward, and that Europe could develop a more reasonable momentum by one element of the Nice Treaty, namely the right of initiative of a qualified number of members of the European Union to move at a different speed compared to the rest. This two-speed or multiple-speed Europe, or this variable geometry Europe, has been discussed time and again. And I have a suspicion. All those guys who are strongly in favor of this approach are not interested in moving Europe forward. May I invite you to just think over how effective Europe is if it adds by every new year one extra member to the Schengen Agreement. This would be a program to maximize the employment in the construction industry, in the equipment industry for airports. Such a solution is as smart as the decision of the Council a few days ago was to have the three committees for regulating financial markets in Paris, Frankfurt, and London, respectively. If the groups that they have to talk to and to coordinate with are located in Brussels. And once a year, the three committees, because they have a lot to discuss among themselves, are asked to meet in one place. And then this smart council decided that after 4 years, the decision may be reviewed. This is a decision to secure the revenues of airlines and of international hotels. It is an idea how to keep experts as long as possible in the air, rather than addressing issues. These are attempts to ruin Europe. These are no attempts to have solutions for Europe. And I could go on and on with examples that are indicative that still simple national interest, parochial interest, and an interest to ruin the idea, rule the day. How could we overcome it? Is there a new leadership on the horizon? Who will be the next Commission president? Who may be the first important president of the European Council that shows leadership qualities? I asked and talked it over with quite a number of politicians. My fellow countrymen in Germany in February 2004 still have no idea how they should be represented in the next commission that is going to be built in less than half a year. They have not yet formed coalitions with other European partners in order to get a solution they consider appropriate. You know what I am expecting and hoping for? That we get a deep, a profound, a strong interest of the new members to get interesting and important posts in the Brussels Commission and other institutions. And I've been lucky enough, and I'm pretty sure here in LSE you are as well, I'm lucky enough to be confronted with people from the accession countries. And I admire their talent. And I admire their motivation to move things. And I'm pretty sure we, the old guys of Europe, will be blamed by the quality people we will soon have in the European institutions. And hopefully this injection of fresh people, fresh ideas, fresh motivation will blame the old guys defending the status quo. And hopefully they are not only good quality professionals and intellectuals. What I sincerely hope for is that they are talented in communication, that they join forces with communicators, and that they finally get a motivation underway to again be spirited about Europe. I warn you that you won't receive a balanced view on Europe, but an emotional one, and one that might look not truly based on facts. If you study the world, and you do, you find out that there is one center of gravity in terms of politics, in terms of the military, in terms of economics. At the center, clearly, is the United States. And it's very obvious. The Americans have not made up their mind deliberately to stay there and to defend their turf. But they will do so very successfully. I'm pretty sure that the underpinnings of their superpower status is fully intact. The US has a birth rate of 2.1 per childbearing women in their childbearing period. We, the Europeans, have 1.4, and the accession countries are at about 1. The UK is not bad with 1.7, stuck in the middle, as in many other respects as well. Italy, the country of bambinis, obviously is the place that is at the end of the league table, together with the Danes, the Spanish, and the Germans. It doesn't seem as if the attitude is going to change anytime soon. And therefore, over the next decades, the aging of Europe will be much more pronounced than the aging in the United States. And this implies, of course, that research, that implementation of innovation is far more natural in the United States than it is in Europe, old and new Europe. Rumsfeld differentiated Europe not according to fertility rates. It's very obvious that at the same time, there's another fundamental economic underpinning of dynamism, and that's entrepreneurial orientation. And again, the United States is clearly, and by a wide margin, in the lead. There, 40% of the young people want to become self-employed, whereas in Europe, it's something like 1/4. It's quite obvious that this different attitude additionally is supported in the United States with a very creative venture capital market, which supports creative entrepreneurial ideas and spirit by providing the necessary risk capital. We Europeans instead prefer time deposits, and if we go further down the road to higher risks, we buy bonds, preferably government bonds. With such a precondition, it's quite obvious that the necessary restructuring to respond to technological change will be much more obviously provided in the United States than it will be in Europe. So much for the economic differences. But why didn't I emigrate to the US? If the analysis is that clear, why am I still around? Why did I, 14 years being a chief economist of Deutsche Bank, instead of joining One Guarantee or something American early on? Because I do believe that there is still a potential, A, and B, there is a need for Europe to respond. Because wherever we have a monopoly, we end up in a deprivation of the consumer. And if there is a monopoly for too long a time, the monopolist may even run into the risk of stumbling over its own feet because he falls asleep. So basically, first, the Americans need a challenge. The superpower needs a challenger, A. And B, I don't see any region of the world capable of becoming a challenger of the United States between now and 2020 other than Europe. Because the next guy who could be on the block is China. But China has not yet even a convertible currency. Certainly not a reasonable financial market. Not at all a risk capital market. And they certainly don't have a democracy and an education system that is up to standards. So it's quite obvious, while China, if developing in a sustained way until 2020, could become a challenger by then, between now and then, Europe would be the only candidate to challenge the United States. Why do I believe that this is still the case? Because we Europeans underutilize our capacities, our capabilities to such a degree that if we would be willing to challenge ourselves and to use our capacities to the full, I'm pretty sure we would be a formidable potential candidate for challenging the United States. European education systems keep students, particularly on the continent, far too long in school. We don't start elementary school before we are 7. We waste time in secondary. We waste, however, a lot of time in the tertiary education. In our universities, people obviously enjoy life rather than work hard. I'm not worried about people enjoying life. That's okay with me, but it should be at their own cost. And the European societies have made up their mind that visiting the opera and going to university is not at your own cost, but at the cost of the collective. And therefore, I guess we are as we are. So we need incentives to do better in education. We could start much earlier to join the labor force. And I'm not arguing for any less effort in education. I'm not arguing for any shorter education. But at a time when technological change is ever faster, and the half-time of any information, of anything, of any technology, is getting ever shorter, I don't understand why the first round education is getting always longer. We obviously, when talking about lifelong learning, should reduce the initial period of first round learning considerably. And of course, that's much more true for the continent than it is for the UK. Secondary. Women participation rates in many of the European countries leave a lot to be desired. We give now girls, thank God, for the last 30 years already, the same quality education that we give it to our boys. And now there are the first studies that indicate that we give girls a much better education than the boys, particularly in elementary and secondary schools, because the teachers in those schools are predominantly female, and the role models for boys discontinue to exist, which is very bad, and boys are no more challenged as they were in the past. And if one gender is losing in the medium and long term, it's certainly the boys, not the girls. And it has to do with the lack of understanding that the faculty in our elementary and our secondary schools is predominantly female. Okay, gender. The participation rates of women in European countries is way below the US standards. And when we in Germany inherited a high participation rate of women in the eastern part of the country, we enforced them to move out of the labor force, factually. We incentivized them to not be in the labor force by crazy unemployment benefits, much too high, and by other systems. We have embarked upon a policy of reducing the work week that has led to results that are unbearable. Continental European annual hours worked are at about 1,600 hours, whereas the US worker has something like 2,000 hours per year. We have very early retirement, and we incentivize early retirement by public pension systems that are already broke today, and of course are suffering badly from early retirement. So we have, on all fronts, made mistakes that caused labor input to be very, very low. We ought to put in place incentives that we start schooling earlier, that we are faster in the initial phase of education, that we work longer hours per week, that we work longer, that we retire at a later age, and we should have government incentives, and we should have a different management style in companies in order to allow a fuller participation of women, and not just in the lower skilled area but in the higher skilled area as well. This is particularly true with respect to women because our economic structure is developing away from the military, the agricultural, and the manufacturing qualifications into the services and into internationalization. And women are much better in services, marketing, sales, and languages. Imagine for a second how successful the Japanese would be if they would allow their women to speak internationally, to be their marketing persons. It is very difficult. And even after many years, Japanese men have still difficulties to speak foreign languages. Women are completely different. In the Japanese case, the differentiation is very strong. In most other cases, the differentiation is quite strong as well. So I wholeheartedly welcome different higher participation rates, and this would, of course, strengthen the potential of Europe to perform much better than it does. In order to achieve that, however, we have to change the tax structure. Before now ending with my normative views, I probably should give you a hint how we will develop. We now got another new country that has joined the club, Slovakia. Slovakia has just introduced a tax system that I do admire, and I believe will become a benchmark for Europe. They've introduced two kinds of taxes, and one rate. The rate is 19%, and the rate is 19% for the value-added tax, without differentiation, and there is an income and corporation tax of 19% as well. This, of course, is a policy that obviously is destroying the chances for tax accountants. And it's obviously not a big thing for auditing firms, but it may be very good for focusing the quality people on doing something that is more market-oriented, that is more creative, that is building a productive potential instead, rather than causing complicated tax systems and auditing systems that we are all used to and all involved in and all are suffering from at the end of the day. So Europe probably will have new benchmarks, benchmarks that are established by the new entrants. Isn't it fascinating how we all benefited from Ireland, this country joining the European Union, and by doing so, moving away from an emigration country, becoming an immigration country, from a country where there was a shortage of risk capital, to becoming one of the places where risk capital became available from all over the world, including Chicago, and those who have emigrated from Ireland to Chicago. Isn't it interesting to see that the concept of Europe and the challenge that comes from new entrants could help the others to learn to innovate? So we do have a potential because we didn't make good use of our resources so far, and if we accept new benchmarks, we would be capable of moving ahead, of growing faster, of becoming the locomotive of the world economy. And if we would, of course, develop such momentum, then some of the disequilibria that plague us today and probably will worry the world in the future could be at least reduced, if not solved. I'm talking about the twin deficit of the United States. The twin deficit of the United States, the current account deficit of 5% of GDP and the budget deficit of 5% of GDP, probably are not sustainable. And if the United States addresses this problem after the presidential election, I'm pretty sure it will be addressed if the Democrat will win. But this is not realistic to be expected. But even if George W. Bush will win, and my probability is it will be 80% probability that he is going to win, there will be a correction of policies in the United States. Fiscal policy will move from expansionary to neutral, and monetary policy will move from expansionary to restrictive. And in the case of a Democrat, fiscal policy would move not from expansionary to neutral, but from expansionary to restrictive. And of course, the Democrats would then blame all the results upon Bush, that he messed it up. But again, we need not discuss that scenario because Bush will win anyhow. If the United States discontinues to perform as a locomotive, then the question is, will the world fall back into stagnation or even recession? Will we probably even have deflation? Who could compensate for the lack of momentum? And of course, many of us believe it could be China. China is an interesting case, and I forecast the growth rates in China to stay at a level of 10% between now and 2008. Why 2008? 2008 is Olympic Games in China, and safely assume we'll have a real estate bubble by then and a lot of investment before that very period. So yes, China will pull. But China, even today, is still only 1/4 of Japan. So the weight of Japan of China is not enough to really compensate for deceleration in the United States. So it ultimately rests upon Europe to take up the role of a locomotive. Is there a realistic scenario for Europe picking up? Will the European Central Bank lower interest rates and pursue stimulative policies? Of course, there's not much room to go. If your repo rate is 2%, there's not a lot that you can do with reduction of interest rates. So at the end of the day, will fiscal policy do the trick? Will fiscal policy become more expansionary in Europe? Now that I've learned that Gordon Brown almost is hitting the 3% deficit, probably in order to not be asked again to join the euro. I wouldn't know whether this is the true explanation. I don't know, but it may be. But certainly the UK is not the most problematic case. It's very obvious that France and Germany are those two countries that unfortunately have pursued socialist policies for too long and protectionist policies for too long and have overspent and have a debt to GDP ratio that is unacceptable and therefore are in no position to pursue expansionary fiscal policies. It's not just the Stability and Growth Pact that stands in the way of such an economic policy. It is economic logic that stands in the way of a more expansionary fiscal stance. However, there is every reason to do structural policies to deregulate the labor market, to have a more incentive-oriented tax policy than the ones that exist today, and to correct the excessive burden that results from too expensive a healthcare and old age provision system. These are the issues that ought to be addressed, and the European Central Bank is right to time and again stress this point. And we have moved in the direction, the necessary direction, but not at all to the necessary degree. And I welcome all those who can help us in my country and in Italy and in France to help, particularly those in the center-left parties of our countries, to continue to pursue policies they have dared to pursue over the last several years. But today I can tell you, in my own country, the Social Democratic Party is almost in disarray and doesn't get public support because they, in the judgment of their members, of their constituency, have pursued policies that are denigrated as neoliberal policies. Supply-side oriented policies, policies to deregulate labor market, to reduce subsidies for smokestack industries, to reduce transfer payments to recipients of old age provision or health care, is something that is considered neoliberal, unsolidaric. And if this judgment again becomes prevalent, then of course Europe loses the only available instruments to reinvigorate the European economy. Then we lose the only instrument to get the Lisbon agenda again adhered to and promoted. Europe pillar or appendix. If there is no revolution, we will remain the appendix. We need a revolution. We need a revolution of leaders, provoked by leaders, but more importantly, by those who do have an interest, a long-term interest, to move Europe forward. If you are interested in attractive inner cities, in quality life, then you better help to revolutionize Europe. I sincerely hope that my presentation tonight has helped to inspire some Europeans to change economic and overall policies, not gradually, not incrementally, but in a revolutionary way, in order to get this continent going again before it's too late. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. I'm sure Dr. Walter would want to say that, of course, his suggestions that university students don't work hard, of course, does not apply to students at the London School of Economics. I do remember, Norbert, having a German research student who said to me on one occasion, I've reached that awkward age where I'm getting too old to stay a research student at the LSE, but I'm too young to go back to Germany with the doctorate. Now, we have 20 minutes or so for questions, and I'm happy to take three or four at a time, and then throw it back to Norbert Walter. There's one here to start with. If you'd care to just ideally to stand up and say who you are as you ask your question.
So my name is Carlos. I am a PhD student in economic history here at LSE. Well, my question is, what is better, is happiness or money? Is welfare or money? Because if we compare not GDP per capita levels between the US and Europe, but human development, welfare estimations like the Human Development Index, the United Nations, we can see that the results for Europe are really good, much better than those for the United States. So in this case, don't you think that you are too pessimistic? And I mean, money is part just of happiness, but not it's not all.
Thank you. Step up.
My name is Stefan Collino. I'm a professor at the European Institute here. Norbert, you mentioned a lot the lack of leadership that we have at the moment, and certainly it looks like the crowd we have at the moment isn't as good as the one we had before. But I wonder whether we are, after all, amongst academics here, whether it isn't worthwhile looking at the structures underneath. It seems to me that in many ways we have in Europe made the poachers the gamekeepers. In fact, what you described about the financial markets and putting up three different ones and everyone wants it here or there is exactly that logic. And what we really would need is to have someone who can somehow maintain the park and make sure that the poachers are put out of the park. And I don't think you really have addressed that issue.
My name is David Radnick. I'm a freelance journalist and an ex-alumnus of LSE. I'd like to make two quick points. First of all, on definition, what hard benchmarks can you produce to justify your condemnation of Europe as just an appendix? When you look at the heavyweight benchmarks, GDP, trade, the EU is the world's biggest trader, I understand, and then investment, Europe can't possibly be dismissed as a mere appendix. My second point is, when you say that the emergence of a more united and integrated Europe is being balked by parochialism and nationalism, that seems to me to be self-evident. Do you think it would be of help to organize a campaign to have the EU as such in the WTO and in the IMF? Because since it has a common external tariff, a common commercial policy, it would seem to me eminently logical for it to be represented in the WTO, and since it has the euro, common monetary policy, one interest rate, why shouldn't it be represented as EU in the IMF?
Why don't we take that?
Yeah. Happiness or money? I'm staying in Europe because I feel happier. I must say the inner city of Houston or Dallas is not exactly my dream. So I really understand your question, but if many of the qualified from Europe have every reason to think of and to act in such a way that what they have acquired here is better implemented elsewhere, and not only for a temporary period, but for permanent, then this should provoke type of questions that I have that I've been addressing. It is very obvious that the Hirschman analysis is very important, that there are three types of votes. The one vote, the expression of by vote, and the expression by purse, and the expression by exit. And I can tell you, I don't trust anybody telling me and giving an answer in a survey that he has certain preferences, if these are not revealed in terms of his or her expenditures, in terms of spending money for what. And if people, for example, tell me that the 3-liter car is the thing to go for, and then if I look into what they buy, it's a sport utility vehicle, I have to learn something. The vote by purse clearly indicates that we are much more American than European. And the vote by exit is even stronger. It is very difficult to see quality people flocking into Europe, but it's quite easy to see quality people flocking into the United States. And I share some of your basic ideas, and that therefore I'm still around in such old European cities. But it's quite obvious that the Americans are more willing to accept structural change, to appreciate structural change, to drive the world, to set the standards, to dominate the world. And the vote by exit, the final vote, is something that obviously indicates that my analysis is taken very seriously by quite a few. As to Mr. Collignon's arguments, I admit that yes, we have some structures that make it very difficult to get things sorted out. And on occasion, I feel that the Europeans insist to avoid developing a critical mass in anything. And there are only a few exceptions to those rules. And wherever we, so to speak, play differently, we of course could and did demonstrate that we are quite capable. For example, it was an initiative by politicians, and I didn't like the initiative by politicians when it came about, but today I have to admit the world is better off by having a second supplier of civil airplanes and not being limited to Boeing. It's quite obvious that I always was arguing if anybody does it in the 80s, in the late 70s, in the 80s, it should be done by Japanese rather than by Europeans, because we had such much more difficult time to organize something between different governments. But the avoidance of critical mass is something I observe time and again. In education, in research, for example, in Europe, it's very obvious that we are not willing to cooperate or to allow initiatives by individuals to overcome that. In education, it is particularly important. And here we are, therefore, in my view, at a loss. The question is, why are we behaving like that? Why? And this brings me to the third question. I believe we always behave as is in the fairy tale Snow White and the Dwarfs. And the United States are the Snow White. And what we ask Snow White time and again is, are we allowed to add the eighth dwarf to the system, to the tale, rather than on occasion trying to change roles? That's not our attitude. As to hard facts for Europe appendix, of course I've exaggerated, and deliberately so. Of course, yes, we are. It's true. My country, these 82 million people, are world champion in exports. We export more than a country 3.5 times as large in population, the United States. And that's true. But on the other hand, we are the continent that has a growth rate of about 1%, when the United States is growing at more than 3% on a long-term basis. We are the guys who have an unemployment rate that is closer to 10%, and the United States, with a much more heterogeneous population, has an unemployment rate of something like short of 5%. That's quite hard figures that we obviously don't live up to our potential, and certainly not to the expectations. And as to investment, it's quite obvious. Capital flows go into the United States. They do afford a $550 billion current account deficit. And therefore, they can afford much more in terms not only of consumption, which is of course not sustainable, but they could afford much higher investment by inviting and by winning over the savers of the poorer savers of the world, to provide their capital to the United States. So these are, I believe, quite a number of hard facts indicating that we are clearly and way behind. And we need not employ the idea of who is political leader in this world, or who is a military leader of the world. And we are not only not capable, we are not even willing to address this issue in a serious way. And the last remark or the last question, why doesn't Europe develop a will to show its stature in international institutions? With respect to WTO, the Europeans have made up their mind. We have our commissioner who is responsible for trade and can speak for Europe, Pascal Lamy. And I must say, if I'm proud about Europeans these days, I'm proud about some of our commissioners. We have some commissioners who are respected, not only in Europe, but internationally. And Pascal Lamy is among them. Pascal Lamy is one of the persons who can speak at the same level with Bob Zoellick. And the two are really helping us to avoid much worse outcomes. It's quite obvious that the advisors, like Karl Rove, to George W. Bush, would have caused more damage to the world economic system and to the world trade order if it wouldn't have been for Bob Zoellick, the man who is the US trade representative. And if Europe wouldn't have had the talented Frenchman, Pascal Lamy, at the helm of the trade negotiations, we would indeed. Anti-globalization groups would have found strange supporters, namely the protectionists, the oldest protectionists in our countries, to fully support their actions. So in WTO, I believe Europe has been moving in the right direction and made suggestions at the Doha round that I found very encouraging. Unfortunately, they were ahead of their times. The proposals made by the European Commission for the Doha round were too ambitious. And I'm very sorry that the G20 or the emerging countries didn't understand that the proposals made by the European Union were very, very supportive for their case. And they should have been in much stronger support for such ideas rather than blocking it and considering it a victory to blame the US and the Europeans of not moving ahead. I believe Cancun was a disaster, particularly for the emerging world. As to the IMF, yes, I like your idea. I'm one of the guys who already has been written about it. I would not only go for the European Union to have the seat in the IMF, I would go even further. I would clearly ask to relocate the IMF, because we are the largest shareholder, and by far. And if you are the largest shareholder, we should, of course, determine the location. And to just indicate that the IMF moves out of Washington probably would help to move it out of the Washington consensus as well. Would be a good symbolic action. Unfortunately, some of the most powerful and credible institutions in Europe stand in the way of such a solution. And these are our proud central banks. Those proud central banks with huge staff and without a job in those countries that have given up their national currency in the euro area.
I'm sitting here thinking what a wonderful negotiation there would then be about where one would put the IMF inside the European Union.
It's very obvious. It is Paris.
Right. There would be those who would argue for Parma and those who would argue that Bratislava had to have it this time, it seems to me. We have room perhaps for just two more questions before we finish. Who else would like to intervene? Yes, over there.
My name is Kim Amlada. I'm a journalist from the Danish news agency. I find that the most worrying development in Europe is the demographic development. Do you foresee any kind of revolution can help that? And to what extent does that affect, I mean, the worrying demographic prospects, does that affect your view on the economics in 10 or 20 years?
Thank you. At the back at the top.
Henning Pizunker, you're a German student, Master of Decision Science. I completely agree with you that the economic performance has to be improved, and that one of the important keys is, yeah, I would like to say, a transformation on organizational level or of the individual attitude towards the economy. But don't you think that this change or this transformation is often on the course of other values in our society? I think about German universities which close faculties of philosophy to improve their business and economics departments. I also think about, for example, the Deutsche Bank, where the CEO has taken a very important role in German politics if we regard the history of the German bank, and that the last two CEOs are at the moment in trial and do also have a very important position in society, but probably not in the way everybody wishes them to have.
Thank you.
This will be tough. As to demography, theoretically, we would be back to the same age structure that we had in 1970. If we would double the fertility as of now, we would reach that in 2070. 2070. This gives you an idea how long-lasting the implications of our decisions after the 1970s are already. And it's very obvious, there is not the slightest chance for having such an increase in fertility. I do believe, however, that we will have an increase in fertility in continental Europe. We probably move up to something like 1.8, 1.9. However, in order to achieve that, we have to revolutionize our life. We the business people, have to develop models, ideas, and an environment that allows family and career. And we have to be very serious about that. And that's not trivial. It's not at all trivial. But it's possible. And it's much more possible today with telejobs, for example, available. In a world where you need not to go to the factory at 8 and come back at 5. It's very obvious that the type of work that is the reality of today allows such a combination of career and family in a much better way than in the past. It's quite obvious that there has to be a mental change to achieve that. Some people believe, however, that we are already on a path to improve that. In Germany, we will have an increase of birth rates in 2004, for sure, and in 2005 as well. And you know what, it does not result from a new mental orientation. It results from the very fact that our well-educated women find it very difficult to get a job now, and therefore are willing to have the child now and next year rather than later. And the same explanation is, I believe, the background for people taking up studies in 2004 and 2005. We have a large increase in the number of our students because we don't have available jobs. So don't mix up the two. This is a short-term deviation. It's not yet the new trend. We basically need, however, such a new trend because the alternative, namely selective immigration into our places, is certainly something that goes beyond what can be digested even by very open-minded societies. It's quite obvious if the net immigration into a country per year goes clearly beyond 0.5 of the population, the capability of integrating the people coming to a country is overstretched. And you end up in political opposition if you have such a migration. Therefore, I'm indeed recommending that we, the Europeans, who will become immigration countries in the future, should learn from traditional immigration countries how to steer, how to guide this process. And if we do so, we can help our demography at least a bit. I do believe we will have an increase in our fertility rates. But I do believe that the aging will still be quite pronounced and necessitates, therefore, a very creative immigration policy, which I believe is not against the interest of the emerging world that may be, at least in some cases, overpopulated. I'm pretty sure that Europe is well advised to have a North Africa and a Middle East policy in order to channel and guide immigration from those places into our places. Today, 70% of the Saudi population is below 20. And we have similar age structures in a number of other Middle East countries and other North African countries. At the same time, when the mean age in Europe goes beyond 50 and is approaching 60. So our demography and the prospects that go with it, I believe, necessitate creativity on both fronts. And of course, we still will age, because even with the net immigration that I would recommend, we end up with increasing age, and we therefore will have fewer entrepreneurs, and we therefore have fewer young people to naturally implement new technologies. And if you have an aging labor force, you most probably end up with investors who prefer to invest in younger societies. And then you end up with an aging population and an aging capital stock. And if you end up with an aging population and an aging capital stock, your productivity certainly is much lower than you are used to and much lower than in your competing countries. And then modernization takes place elsewhere, and therefore the world ticks elsewhere. And that's something that is, in my view, something that in the medium and longer run is unavoidable. Therefore, I invited my girls, before they're married, to marry to a Chinese, so that I would be among the surviving races. But they didn't listen, unfortunately. European transformation, however, at the cost of other values, clear trade-off. Yes, if you listen to those who suggest economic policy reorientation, they often sound as if they would be only interested in quarterly results. If, however, supply-side orientation would be misinterpreted as quarterly result orientation or as shareholder orientation that degenerated into sharehopper valuation, then of course we would end up in a world that is not livable, that is not worth living in. And I'm pretty sure already today we have too few people that are capable to think interdisciplinary and to indeed understand that we have two parts of our brain and that we only truly enjoy life and truly function if we make good use of both parts of our brain. And I can tell you I fully understand your request, and I never would think of any studies that do not insist to have a studium generale, to have a value orientation. I'm very happy to be in a college advisory board that is the one European College of Liberal Arts for exactly that reason. And I can tell you, I need not invite people to come into this school. There is a deep felt need for such an education. This implies, of course, that you have to try harder and to work harder, but that's still a possibility. I guess your reading of our last two CEOs could be improved. I've been a person who has been around in Deutsche for the last 17 years. And of course, you certainly can imagine that I admired Alfred Herrhausen. And I still remember the very minute when in Brussels a person told me in the ear, when I listened to Jacques Delors, your CEO has been assassinated. And I know Alfred Herrhausen would have been a great asset for German unification and the economic policies pursued. They wouldn't have been as ill-designed as they were. Yes, but it's very obvious that in a media world, one little sign or one little word is misinterpreted and is used against you. And on occasion, I would be lucky if we would have fewer cameras and fewer microphones to cause such damage as it has been done. A CEO who concentrates on building a global financial institution must not be a person who is not at the same time a very devoted corporate citizen. And if you would have a chance to talk to Breuer or to Josef Ackermann, you would find out that they are true, honest, and very serious corporate citizens. And they're not only proud that they are corporate citizens, they understand that it is their duty to be corporate citizens.
Thank you very much indeed. We really must stop there. Let me have two final comments. Before we started, Norbert told me he has so far two grandchildren. I note that he needs another 2.2 to be up to the required average, and I hope that that will happen in time. Secondly, as he was talking, I was reflecting on his calls that we all have to work longer and think about a different approach to retirement. I'm happy enough every now and again to listen to a young economist called Eric Rohl, who is now only working part-time. He's, I think, 94. And perhaps in 2039, when Norbert is approaching something of the same age, we will hope that you will still be working part-time then and giving advice on the politics of the European economy.
As a grand-grandpa.
But thank you very much indeed for that extremely wide-ranging talk.